Today is a national holiday, so we'll have a special program, and today we'll be devoting the whole program to one of the most acclaimed books to be published in the last couple of years, the Man Booker Prize shortlisted novel, The Glass Room, by the British writer Simon Moore. It's a book with more than a passing relevance to the Czech Republic, as its hero is a building that stands to this day on the edge of the city of Brno. The Villa Tugendhat, designed in the late 1920s by Mies van der Rohe, is a celebration of steel, glass and space, an enduring reminder that modern materials can make for exquisitely sculptural architecture. In Simon Moore's novel, the villa takes on a fictional identity. He creates two hugely likable characters in the couple who commission the villa, Liesel Landauer and her husband Victor, a thriving Jewish industrialist. As the Nazi occupation looms, they are forced to leave the house, and the villa becomes an SS-run clinic, a small part in the mosaic of the Holocaust. After the war, its slide into obscurity continues, although the villa and its amazing glass room remain closely tied to the fates of the people who come and go in the decades that follow. Their lives intertwine, reflected through the fate of a single, quite extraordinary building. Simon Moore was in Prague recently, and I took the opportunity to talk to him about his book. I began by asking him how difficult it was to write about a building, capturing a sense of light, space, texture and movement in words.
It is the problem of being a novelist, but also one of the delights, and part of the sort of trickery of writing novels is that you've got to write about things that are not necessarily cerebral. You've got to be able to write about the visual.
And also, I suppose, the way that we talk about architecture, the ideas of architecture, inspire the way we see it.
Yeah, it has to be seen in context. Just nearby here in Wenceslas Square, you can see some buildings, the Batya building, for example, which many a tourist would walk past and dismiss, thinking it's a piece of 1960s typical office block type architecture, was in fact it's a classic. Built at about the time that the Tugendhat House was built, which is the model for the Landauer House in the glass room. And it is seeing these things in context, particularly with this style of architecture, which can be so brilliant and is possibly too easy to design, because it did lead to, all throughout the 60s, 70s, some very poor imitations.
And I find it very interesting as well when Liesel, one of the central characters in the book, comes back to the house after many years. She's blind, isn't she? So she is actually experiencing the building through how she feels the space and her senses.
Yes, this is true. That was actually almost, probably was, the first passage that I wrote. And for no real reason at the time, I had this idea of Liesel not being able to see it any longer, which of course, as you imply, sort of forced her to apprehend it through other means, memory, of course, but also the other senses.
The building, the Landauer Villa, makes no pretense not to be the Tugendhat Villa, which really does stand in Brno. It's very much the same building designed by Mies van der Rohe. I think that the architect in the novel, Rainer von Abt, you put Mies van der Rohe's words into his mouth when he talks about him being a poet of space and light. And I find that fascinating, the fact that there's this building which survives all through the different periods of Czech history, the very traumatic periods of Czech history over 70 years, while the people come and go, while horrendous things happen, and yet the work of art is there, standing from beginning to end.
Yes, I think almost the last words of the book refer to the fact that the building is just a building.
Maybe if you could read the last paragraph. I think it doesn't portray too much of the plot for people who haven't read the book. So
it's not a plot spoiler. And all around them is the glass room, a place of balance and reason, an ageless place held in a rectilinear frame that handles light like a substance and volume like a tangible material and denies the very existence of time.
And in a sense, this is a building which is embodying the spirit of internationalism, of openness.
Yes, I think one of the themes of the book is this, the contrast. Maybe it's the principal theme, the contrast between the transparency of the architecture and the opposite of the human lives that go on within it. We can aspire to transparency, and politicians do all the time, but in fact, it's something that we don't achieve.
And this book, The Glass Room, isn't your first novel set in Moravia, in what's now the Czech Republic, in fact in Brno, because you wrote Mendel's Dwarf, which is about Gregor Mendel, the father of genetic science, who lived in a monastery in the 19th century in Brno. Tell me about your interest in this country.
Well, that was the start of it, really, the interest in Gregor Mendel. I'm a biologist by training, and the first time I ever came to the Czech Republic, which is now, I think, 16 years ago, the first place we went to was Brno. And the only thing I knew about Brno, I didn't at that stage even know that the Tugendhat House was there. I knew about the Tugendhat House, but I didn't know that it was actually in Brno, but I did know about Mendel, and that's what I went to see. I went to see the Augustinian convent in Stare Brno, and from that grew Mendel's Dwarf, the novel, which, incidentally, the translation's just finished into Czech and is going to be published this autumn.
And that led you on to The Glass Room?
Yes. I must admit, when I got to Brno and started looking around, I was fascinated by it, very intrigued by it as a city. It's a city which it's possible to understand, possibly partly because of its size, quite quickly. It's a city with an awful lot of interest to it. It's structurally interesting, it's historically interesting. It's a city that always feels put down by Prague, I think, and previously, of course, put down by Vienna, which is far closer. And I think it's a city with great, great character. It's also produced a remarkable number of people of importance.
Who do drift in and out of the book, in fact, of the glass room, don't they? The people who visit the Tugendhat Villa, the Landauer Villa, as it is in the novel.
Yes, there was obviously a lively cultural life to the city between the wars, and there are a number of names that I put in for amusement. One of them, of course, being Milan Kundera's father, who is just mentioned in passing, who was a musician and was a pupil of Jan Acek, and another one being the other musician who deserves a lot more attention, I think, which is Kapralova.
Vítězslava Kapralová, who in fact died at a very early age, but had already produced some fantastic music, hadn't she?
Yes, I mean, quite extraordinary character with an extraordinary story, which has been written about in what I believe is called a novel by Jiří Mucha, her husband, but it's only available in Czech, which is annoying.
And you mentioned Milan Kundera's father. Comparisons have been made by critics between one of the characters in the novel, Tomáš, and there is in fact a Tomáš in The Unbearable Lightness of Being, if I remember rightly, who is in a sense quite a similar character, isn't he, living in post-war communist Czechoslovakia and looking for his own identity through his affairs with women.
That was a completely conscious echo of Kundera, because what I wanted to do at that stage was change the tone of the novel. I didn't really set out to write parody or pastiche. I did want to change the tone of the writing, though, when it came to the post-war period compared with the 1920s and 1930s. I had in the back of my mind, during the 20s and 30s, writers like Robert Musil, another native of Brno. And then when shifting to the post-war period, I wanted to get some flavour of the writing of the time, thinking of Kundera, not necessarily The Unbearable Lightness of Being, although the name Tomáš is there. Actually, I use Tomáš because I rather like it as a name. But yes, he has his philosophy, a personal one, which he uses for trying to deal with the situation, which is essentially oppressive and appalling. And his idea is that he will ignore the past and ignore the future, and just the present is all that matters.
And it's interesting that Tomáš is a doctor, isn't he? And there are several doctors who appear in the course of the book. Also the Hauptsturmführer Stahl, who is this really horrific character from the time of the occupation, who's carrying out experiments in eugenics, human genetics. And I know that this is something that you're interested in your writing, and also as a biologist, the relationship between science and art, or also between science and morality.
I think this is enormously important and interesting. I'm not a geneticist as such, but it is the aspect of biology which interests me the most. And it is extraordinarily important. It is easy to overemphasize its importance. I don't have any doubt whatever about the fact that there is an awful lot more to the human machinery merely than the blueprint. But I have no doubt that the blueprint is there.
After we've seen so much passion and warmth in the earlier part of the book, and the wonderful descriptions of the onyx wall that the architect persuades them to commission him to include in the building, then there's this sudden turn when they have to leave the building, and the building becomes a place where genetic experiments are being carried out during the German occupation. And Hauptsturmführer Stahl, whose name actually means steel, doesn't it, in German, is carrying out these experiments. And I would love it if you could read a short extract maybe about this, which just sort of puts the building into such a different and horrific context.
Precision, the cool gaze of scientific objectivity. The measurement is as perfect as the dimensions of the glass room itself. Now we will just take some photographs, and then everything is done. Please take off your gown and hand it to the assistant. This is a scientific examination. We are all scientists here, and the records are entirely confidential. Stahl watches.
And, of course, these experiments, we all know what they were part of. They were part of the machinery of genocide. Was it very hard writing about the Holocaust, because it's a subject that so many people have written about, and it's so difficult for us people who are born after the Second World War really to be able to approach it, and to be able to approach it in a way that is, I think, meaningful or honest?
Yeah, well, I think the important thing is that I don't write about the Holocaust. It's all there by implication. What I'm writing about here, you use the word experiments, but they're not, strictly speaking, experiments. They're genetic measurements. They're measurements of phenotype, which is very different from experimentation. The experimentation that was carried out in the name of genetics and race, which took place in Auschwitz under Mengele, was absolutely horrific and barbaric, and everybody knows about that. What I've shown happening in the glass room is the measurement of human phenotype that took place not just during the war, but before the war, which was a perfectly standard part of genetics, biometrics, started off in Britain, actually, under Galton, a cousin of Charles Darwin, and became very important, particularly in German science. And all the people who were concerned with it, people like Stahl, actually continued after the war and remained in positions of great importance in genetic institutes throughout Germany. So it was very much the academic side of things. And we know that there was the awful dark side that was going on. That's implied. It's never described in the novel. Also, of course, this less dark side, we now understand, was complete nonsense from a scientific point of view. But it was very much believed then that you could do things like measure people's features and derive various indices which would enable you to talk about the Slav race, the Aryan race, the Jewish race, things like that. It was all standard academic stuff then.
And today, I mean, in today's science, obviously with the advances in the study of DNA, etc., is there a danger again of that coming back, in a sense? Because there are all sorts of very scientific measurements that can be made about where your origins are that seem certainly to us today, far more scientific, far more objective, for want of a better word, that could potentially be abused?
Yes, I think they could, and from our perspective, they almost certainly will be abused. One of the obvious things, and indeed Mendel's dwarf deals with this, is the fact that we will gain control over our genetics, and we will be able to choose qualities that we wish to see in our children. We'll only be able to do it in a relatively limited way for an awful long time, I suspect, because the thing about human genetics is very complex, and we will take an awful long time to understand how that works. But individual genetic traits, we will be able to choose. Whether we do or not, of course, is an issue that remains to be dealt with. But we will be able to. My great fear is that what will happen, instead of having state genetics, as the Nazis wanted, we'll end up with a sort of free market genetics, where the rich will be able to choose the qualities that they want for their children, and, because they'll be lacking in imagination, judging by the way human taste goes, they'll all want their children to look like Ken and Barbie.
It's quite a scary thought. I mean, another thing that I find quite disturbing in The Glass Room is there seems to be a fatalism in it, that people aren't really able to influence their fates. That I read in one essay that you've written where you ask the question, what if God really were to play dice? This sense of us being in this world, that nasty things happen to us that we have precious little chance to influence, which seems to be the case of most of the characters in The Glass Room.
I suppose I am, in a sense, a fatalist. I'm certainly a pessimist. I think that's a sensible and logical attitude to take. It's also the best attitude to take if you want to be happy, because if you're a real pessimist, then you can only be pleasantly surprised by what happens, whereas if you're an optimist, you always have your optimistic ideas dashed by reality.
The Glass Room has recently been translated into Czech, and your earlier novel, also set in Brno, Mendel's Dwarf, also is just about to appear in Czech. You've been travelling around the Czech Republic the last few days. What have been your impressions of how people have received these books?
They've been extraordinarily positive. I've enjoyed myself immensely in the last few days and have had wonderful audiences of people who really seem delighted with The Glass Room.
And you were in Brno as well, where the book is set, and in fact the town Město is translated into Czech in the Czech version of the book as Brno, so there's no doubt where we are. Did you have the impression that in Brno your book was particularly welcomed?
Indeed I did, yes. We were guests of the city. For me, it was a mixture of fun and also a very emotional experience, actually, because I've only ever been to Brno before as just a sort of ordinary person whom the city doesn't take any notice of, and suddenly I seem to matter. And I took that as a great honour and sort of privilege.
I'd like to ask you as well about your next book, which has the working title Trapeze, I understand. So can you tell me a little bit about what it's about?
I can tell you a little bit about it. I'm actually quite advanced with it. I've written over three quarters of it, and I think my publisher is intending to publish it next year. I'm not going to say too much about it, except that it is a period piece again. It's set in the 1940s. It doesn't concern the Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia, though. It's set in France and in Britain during the 1940s. And, of course, there were fairly major events going on at that time.
And it's interesting, I mean, you've come back to the subject of the Second World War on several occasions in your books, and also you tie it in a lot with memory, don't you?
Yes, both those things. Part of it is my age and circumstance. I was born immediately after the Second World War, and therefore my parents' experiences were, a lot of them were during the Second World War. My father was a pilot in the Royal Air Force. Now that has some effect. The other thing is, of course, the Second World War remains an extraordinarily defining moment in world culture, I suppose, but certainly in European culture, with all the after effects of it.
You've managed to have a career as a novelist in parallel with working as a teacher of biology. Nearly all the teachers I know, they have a tired, exhausted look. It astonishes me that you've managed to combine the commitment required to be a teacher with the energy to write novels as well.
But the sort of teaching I do has not been too tiring and demanding, I don't think. It depends, I suspect, where you teach and how you teach. There are long holidays. I chose teaching in order to have long holidays so that I could write. And I must admit, for the last 32 years, I've been involved with a school in Italy, which is where I live, an international school. And the demands of teaching in an international school are probably different from the average demands of teaching in a British school.
You think that the children are more motivated, there aren't the social problems that you might have in a more typical school?
I think that very much, yes. They're also extremely interesting. And they have introduced me to something which does interest me, which comes into the classroom, which is the bilingual or the multilingual culture, which I find extremely interesting. And of course, Gniezno in the classroom was a bilingual city.
And you actually play with the very name of the room, the glass room, which in German is Glasraum, and the word Raum has all sorts of other associations in German about space. And then in Czech it's pokoj, which also means peace or tranquility in Czech. You enjoy these puns, don't you?
Yes, of them, yes. And I, when I discovered pokoj, I was delighted. I thought the Czech language has just delivered me a gem here.
In a sense, the whole book strikes me as being something of a gem. It's beautifully crafted. Have any critics said that maybe it's too beautifully crafted, that it's too perfect?
I don't think anybody's suggested that it's overdone. What is interesting is that I don't structure books consciously. The structure comes out of the writing and the rewriting and the rewriting. And this record is not stuck, and the rewriting. One works over the book all the time, and for me, that's where the structure emerges.
Simon Moore, thank you very much indeed for talking to us about your book, The Glass Room, and your other work as well. I'd like to end with you reading an extract from the book, from a description of the glass room itself. There are several descriptions in the course of the book of the room, and they create wonderfully vividly the sense of this space. This is from roughly the middle of the book, one of the descriptions where we get a real sense of this room.
This is actually when the family has just left. The glass room is almost empty. The piano stands where it has always stood, in the space behind the onyx wall. But except for that and a couple of chairs, all the rest has gone. In some ways, this has returned the room to its moment of birth, when the builders and the decorators left it, and the furniture had yet to arrive. Just the space, the light, the white. Just the gleaming chrome pillars. Just the onyx wall and the curved partition of Macassar wood. The cool, calm rationality of the place, undisturbed by any of the irrationality that human beings would impose upon it. They pause for a moment and look.